Welcome to the Tim Hill Podcast. If you have the time, you can not only listen to the episodes, but you can also watch all the shows, and you'll find the links in the description below. Thank you. Boom, I'm in the room. Good evening, everybody. Welcome to Everyday Conversations Regarding Mental Health. Because there's nothing on the telly, that's why you're here, to watch the Lord Hill. That's coming to you live from the Old Hill Manor. Got a great guest for you this evening. This evening, we're going to be looking at loving an addict and living with yourself, loving yourself. Now, don't forget Tuesdays with the old live stream awesome quiz. That goes live at 7 every week. And if you do miss it, you can always get it on a catch up. And if you do get it on a catch up, just remember to put your scores in the chat box. So this show is all about taking the stigma out of mental health. It's all about making people feel comfortable talking about mental health, mental well-being, and that's what we're all about on this show. So without too much further ado, I'm going to bring in my guest for this evening, and we're going to be talking about addicts and loving them and loving yourself. So without further ado, welcome, Candice. Good evening. How are you?
Hello, Tim. Hi, everyone.
You're welcome. So, Candice, can you tell us a little bit about yourself, how you got to where you are today and what you do today?
Yes. Yes. Today is very different than it's been. Today, I am an addictions therapist. I'm in private practice in Vancouver, Canada. And I've been doing this work for about 30 years. I work specifically with the families and other loved ones of people who are struggling with addiction because there's so little help out there for them. And, you know, this is a rampant problem all over the world. I don't know what your situation is like in England. I don't know whether you're having the same problems with addiction and opioid overdose and all of that we're having here in North America, but it's just horrible. And families are losing loved ones to overdose. And it's a really difficult problem. So I was telling you before the show that in about 6 weeks, I'm going to be 36 years clean and sober, one day at a time. And that comes on the heels of having had a pretty devastating opioid addiction myself for about 15 years because of I was diagnosed with Crohn's disease in the early 70s, and the doctors had no idea what to do for me. It was a new disease for them, and they didn't know what to do. So what they did was they prescribed a lot of addictive medications. They prescribed Valium, and they prescribed codeine and morphine and those kinds of opioids that that anybody's body would get addicted to. And mine did. I could get as much of it as I wanted, as often as I wanted. And I would just keep going back to their office and say, "Ooh, I've run out." And they wouldn't say to me, "Well, how much are you using?" They would just write another prescription for me. So 15 years later, all of those substances are depressants in the human system. So 15 years later of using all of these, I was pretty depressed. to the point where I wasn't sure if I wanted to live anymore. I had this very debilitating, painful physical disease. And then on top of that, my life was a mess because of these opioids. I had no idea that I was addicted. Addiction wasn't on the radar at that point. So I had no idea. I just knew that something was very wrong with my life. And then I met some people who were going to 12-step programs, AA and Narcotics Anonymous, and I started going with them. And that was the beginning of my recovery back in the mid-80s. So, yeah.
Wow.
Backstory.
That's a tough old story, that. I mean,
yeah.
Doctors are very, very quick to prescribe antidepressants. I was struggling a little bit. When I came out of the army, a couple of years after I'd left the army, probably around about 2020. Yeah, it would have been about 2020, a couple of years after. I recognised in myself I was struggling a little bit. I thought I needed a little bit of professional help. So I went to the doctors. First thing he was offered was going to offer me some antidepressants. Don't need drugs. Just want to talk to someone. So anyway, he referred us on. I went to see a civilian psychologist, whatever they are. They were good at what they did, but they couldn't help me very much because they didn't understand what I've come through, what I've seen, being a military person. But I went and spoke to some mates who had been through similar stuff with me, and we managed to get us all ironed out. So I'm okay. But it's just that initial offering some pills. It's not what one needs.
Yeah, and it's really, it's an irony with antidepressants because, you know, they're not really addictive in the same way that opioids and benzodiazepines and those kinds of drugs are addictive, but they're prescribed for people who are depressed, obviously, and if people take too many antidepressants, like if you take an overdose of antidepressants, you can die from it. Mm. So it's really not the right thing to be given to, you know, people who are depressed and thinking about offing themselves. It's an interesting thing. I'm glad you got help. I'm glad you did that.
Yeah, it is peer help that really helped. And I mean, unfortunately, the area I live in, it's the most densely populated area in the UK for veterans. So there's loads of them around to take the mickey out of you whenever you need to. And that's generally the way that the military deal with these things, is taking the mickey out of you.
Yeah, it's one way.
So 15 years in, how was your journey of coming out of taking opioids?
For the last 35 years, do you mean? Or?
Yeah. I mean, the initial stages, when you first tried to get off them.
It's horrible. Horrible, yeah. No, they're not, excuse me, they're not fun to be addicted to. They're not fun to take, and they're not fun to come off of. The only part of fun, you know, you talk about addicts partying, you know, it's only a party for about a minute and a half, and then it gets to be really awful. Addiction is a really awful place to be. And a worse place to be is somebody who loves somebody who's addicted, because there's so little help for them out there, and they're doing things, you know, families are doing things that maybe they shouldn't be doing. They don't mean to hurt. They want to help, but there's not a lot of people out there like myself who can let them know, well, maybe you might want to try this instead, because there's a huge difference between enabling addict who's in active addiction and helping an addict in active addiction. When you enable somebody, you're basically keeping them stuck, helping to keep them stuck in the addiction. And helping them is a different thing. It helps them come out. It assists them to come out of addiction. So I work a lot with families around the difference between enabling and helping, and teach them how to set healthy boundaries, because they're often allowing the addict to manipulate them and bully them and speak to them very poorly and physically be violent. And it's a terrible situation to be a loved one of an addict until you learn what you can do and what you need to stop doing. And then so it gets a lot easier.
Yeah, we've got a comment coming from Sandra. Let's put it up there. Thank you for joining us this evening, Sandra. Have you tried microdosing? Microdosing.
Yeah. With she's looking at drugs that are like ayahuasca and mushrooms and things like that. And you know, there's new science coming out about microdosing with mind-altering substances. I prefer not to do that. This is just a personal feeling. I see that a little bit as harm reduction. I don't have enough scientific evidence yet that that helps, you know, in any kind of long-term basis. So what works for me is abstinence. What works for me is getting to the root of why people, including me, why people need to hurt themselves, why people need to sabotage their lives, and figuring out a different way to live so that people can feel people can feel good about themselves. Microdosing for me as an addict in recovery and also as a therapist working with this, it's not something that I would probably ever touch. But that's just a personal opinion.
So you've seen that type of treatment used then?
Well, I know about that type of treatment. I know that it's relatively new, and I know that, you know, some people swear by it and other people don't. And there just isn't enough scientific evidence yet to convince me that giving even small doses of mind-altering substances is a better way than getting underneath what the addiction is really about. Because the addiction itself is only a symptom of what's really going on for the person. And we need to find going on for the person. Why are you hurting yourself? Why are you hurting the people around you? Why do you feel so badly about yourself that you feel like you need to do that? Let's get some of those questions answered and move into a path of recovery. That's what I would prefer to do.
So you work alongside addicts and their families.
Yes, I work with the addicts when they're ready for help. Usually when families come to me, it's usually the parents of adult children or the spouse of somebody who's addicted. It's usually that way that the family member will come first and say, I'm just at the end of my rope. I don't know what to do. I love him. I hate him. You know? So it's usually the family members that contact us first. And then we work with them for a while. They start making some changes. The addict sits up and takes notice and says, uh-oh, you know, maybe I'd better start changing some stuff. When the addict is ready for help, we're happy to work with them, but not when they're not. Not when they're going to try to be manipulative with us and abusive with us. Not interested
in that. I guess from an addict's point of view, it's realizing that you've got the problem. And until an addict recognises that it's their problem, and it's only them that can make that decision to get out of it, can start helping.
It's an interesting point that you're raising, because as an addict myself, I mean, I knew I had a problem. There's no question that addicts know deep inside that they have a problem. When they're living under the bridge or don't have enough money for food because they're spending addiction, you know, they know there's something wrong with that picture. They look around at other people who are living different kinds of lives than they are, people with families and children and jobs and meaning in their lives, you know. So it's really a question of, I mean, addicts already know, but we're terrified, really, to give up whatever the addiction is, whatever the substance or behavior is that we've been using to get through life, that we think is the only way we can get through life. Don't take this from me, because I don't know how to live with live life without this, you know. And so the change starts to happen when the courage is developed to face life on life's terms.
Yeah.
Instead of how we want it to be, facing what it is so that we can change it to what we want it to be, you know? So that's why we need to get underneath addiction and find out what's really going on. But I really like the point that you're making. Addicts already know that they have a problem. Definitely. They're just not ready or sure that they can do it without the gambling or the porn or the chocolate, you know, or the heroin.
Or the booze.
Or the booze.
So many people find that going out on a night out, they can't enjoy themselves if they don't get drunk.
That's right. And then, that's right.
And,
but there's
and when they under, when they do go like, out then, and not drink, and they find that they're having a better time, particularly with friends that are in the same boat that aren't drinking, that can have a great time without getting drunk.
Or maybe they have one or two because they like the taste of it, but they don't let themselves blottoed out to the point where they don't have to remember that they hate their lives and they hate themselves. And let's figure that out.
Yeah. I mean, I had a conversation with somebody the other day, and we were talking about alcoholism and being able to go out without drinking, or nowadays it's becoming far more acceptable to drink non-alcoholic beer. And it's come a long way from the early days of being near beer. So you can go and have the drink without getting all the side effects of alcohol.
Yes, I mean they've had the non-alcoholic stuff now for almost as long as I've been in recovery. So they've had it for, you know, 20, 25, 30 years. They've had time to perfect the taste of it, because I remember tasting non-alcoholic beer, alcoholic champagne. Ew, awful. And, you know, now it's easy to get a virgin anything, right? A virgin Rita or anything, you know. So I'm really glad they have those, because some people just like the taste of beer but want to be clean and sober in their lives. They want to mow the lawn and sit down and have a beer, but they're in recovery. And now they can do that in a way that tastes okay.
It's a bit like smoking. I remember the days of when you walked into a pub and you came out and you actually reeked. And nowadays you're not allowed to smoke in any pubs, certainly not in this country. And it's a much, much nicer environment to go into. So that's another addiction. That's smokers are sort of banished now.
You know, in Canada, they've just passed a law where they're going to be making every single cigarette, the actual cigarette, have a warning label on it. You know, caution, this can cause cancer kind of warnings. Not on the packages, but on the actual cigarettes.
Hmm.
I saw that on the news the other night, and I thought, well, I wonder what the ink is that they're using to put on these cigarettes, and is that going to be even more carcinogenic? And people already know that these are going to cause cancer. They're in denial. They're going to think that it's going to cause cancer in everybody and not in them. My father died of lung cancer because of smoking. You know, it'll get us all. I was a smoker as well. I loved it. He bought my cigarettes for me, you know, when I was a kid. But it's horrible for you. It turns your lungs black. It's awful. Mm. And we don't need warnings on cigarettes. We need to have cigarettes taken away. These are not good things.
I mean, that's the rub, isn't it? I mean, that's the rub. The government won't ban smoking totally.
It's money. It's
because
money.
Because it's a money earner. It's where they get tax money from. And a packet of cigarettes in the UK nowadays is a ridiculous amount of money.
It's exorbitant. I know. I remember I lived in the States and I was able to get a pack of Winstons, I think, for like 25 cents for a pack of 25 cigarettes, you know. Yeah. But now it's like, I was going to say $150. I'm exaggerating. But now it's like $80 to get a carton of cigarettes.
Yeah, that's really crazy.
And people do it for what? To smoke, to put tar to your lungs. So, you know, again, when we talk, I mean, I understand that I was a smoker. I'm an addict. I get it. But we need to get underneath what your need is to put tar into your lungs. How do you not respect yourself enough to say, I'm not going to do this to myself anymore?
Yeah. And it's the same with all addictions, really. It's addict. So you're addicted to it. It's easy to pick up and start. It's so difficult to actually stop.
It's difficult until you develop some courage and some self-respect and really understand that. It's getting you nowhere except bad stuff. And so, you know, addicts need their families to love them and care about them and support them, but in healthy ways with healthy boundaries. And when that happens, an addict starts to develop that resiliency. When a family says to them, We love you so much. We love you. We don't want to see you in a life of addiction. It tears us up to watch you do this to yourself. We don't want to support it. We're not going to support it anymore. If you choose, because ultimately addiction is a choice more than it's anything else, more than it's a disease or, you know, it's a choice we make to either be in addiction or be in recovery, you know.
Yeah.
Or to be absent. And so addict that I love so much, if you're going to make the choice to continue being an active addiction, then you're going to be on your own doing that. When you want to be in recovery, when you'd like to get some help and you're really ready for that, then let us know because we'll support you in that. But we're not, and it's because we love you. This is not a punishment. It's because we love you, not because we don't love you. And when families can give that message to addicts recover.
Yeah. It's called tough love.
It is called tough love. And some people have said to me, you know, I showed you my book before. I'm going to just hold it up again. Yeah. It's called Loving Yourself. It's the top 10. Have I got it?
Yeah, you got it.
The top 10 survival tips for loving someone with an addiction. So this book is for you if you're the loved one of an addict. Don't give this book to your addict, because addicts hate my book. My book is about boundaries. My book is about, you know, healthy things. And addicts who are still using don't like that. But my book is, you know, people read my book, and some of them, most of them really appreciate it. But some of them say, well, that's just tough love. And we don't like tough love. We're not going to do tough love. Well, you know, tough is love. And sometimes love looks like no more. Yeah. We're done. We love you and we're done.
Of course, the addicts don't, I mean, they don't respect themselves to start with. So if they don't respect themselves, how are they going to respect the ones that love them?
Yeah.
Until they come to terms.
And again, that's such a great point that you raised, because the loved ones have been allowing themselves to be abused by the addicts, manipulated and abused. So they need to develop their own self-respect to be able to say no more. We teach people how to treat us. We teach other people how to treat us. And so if I allow you to abuse me, I'm basically telling you it's okay for you to do that to me.
Mm.
If I want you to abuse me, then I have to stop abusing myself. I have to stop letting it happen, start believing in myself more, start looking at why I haven't respected myself and heal that. That's the kind of thing I work with. So I work with the family first to develop some self-respecting boundaries with the addicts that they love, so that the addicts can then learn how to respect themselves. When an addict stops using, man, when I stopped using, it was so hard. It was horrible. I remember being in the fetal position on my living room floor, just, you know, let me die now. But at the same time, I was really proud of myself. It was like a pat myself on the back kind of moment, because I chose, even as hard as it was, I chose to continue to not use. I chose to not pick up a drug, even though that would have helped me for a minute and a half. And I started feeling better about myself. And it's that can be just as progressive as an addiction can be. So I'm now addicted to self-respect, and it's not negotiable in my life anymore.
So the initial stages, I guess, as each day goes past, it gets slightly easier to keep saying
slightly easier.
I mean, once you get over the shock of stopping taking it, so you're going to
learning how to do it in a different way. And if you've got the DTs, if you need detox, then you've got to go to detox the people there know how to help you. You know, if you don't want to put yourself at risk physically, you don't want to put your life at risk by trying to come off a drug or an alcohol or alcohol that could actually kill you if you come off it too fast. You want to have people who you, and there are people everywhere in the world. There are people now who can help addicts. So, you know, it's like there's an ego thing of, well, I can do it on my own. Well, maybe, but it could kill you too. So you might want to get some help.
I mean, would your local GP be the first point of contact?
Maybe.
Because they're the ones that's prescribing the stuff in the first place.
Well, you know, unfortunately, when the doctors were prescribing it to me in the 70s and 80s, in their defense, I don't think they knew what they were unleashing upon me, because addiction wasn't on the radar. We weren't talking about it. People were still hiding it, right? Mm-hmm. Now, I mean, addiction is so prevalent. It's talked about all the time. Most people either are addicts, or they know somebody who's an addict, or they know a family that's dealing with this, because that's how prevalent it is. And the doctors know that, and they know how addictive these substances are, but they're prescribing them anyway. And there's an awesome drama about this. It's called Dope Sick. Dope as in drugs, right? Dope Sick. And Michael Keaton is one of the lead actors in this drama, and he plays a doctor who continues to prescribe opioids to his patients because there's a financial kickback for him. And then he gets addicted to them himself as the physician. It's a beautifully done drama if you're interested in something like that, and if you like Michael Keaton, because he's great in it. But it's a very scary thing. And, you know, these salesmen come to doctors' offices and say, here, I'm going to give you samples. Give it to your patients. It's going to be great. And it never is. It's addictive.
And a lot of it is actually driven by money.
It is. Addiction is driven by money. Fentanyl, driven by money. Societies that enable addiction, driven by money. And that's very angry for me. I see it all the time.
And a lot of it's down to Big Pharma as well. I mean, the Big Pharma. The amount of money that they make is unbelievable.
Yeah. Well, that's what this drama is about. This drama I was talking about, Dope Sick, is about the Sackler family, who came up with OxyContin and sold it as a non-prescriptive drug. And the Food and Drug Administration, the FDA of the United States, gave them patents for it, because guess why? Money.
Yeah. And I think that's possibly the root of most evils, actually, money and power.
But the thing is, as one person, I can't stop that. But as one person, I can help your family stop that. And then I can help your family stop that. And then I can help that family, right? As one person, I can do what I can do. If we could all get together and say, we are tired of Big Pharma making all this money off of drugs, then they would stop making money off of drugs. Then they'd take the cigarettes away. They just wouldn't put warnings on the cigarettes. That's ridiculous. Ridiculous.
And they still sell them.
Of course, and they'll still be smoking them. And the ink will probably, affect people's lungs and right? It's just a ridiculous way of dealing with it. That's not what has to happen. But there's too much money involved for it. I get really passionate about this. If people are listening, it's like, forgive me. I get passionate. I get angry. Because too many people are dying out there, at least in North America they are.
Yeah, the same in the UK and across
Europe. Hundreds of people a day are dying from addiction.
Hmm. I think there's a town in Scotland, Glasgow, which is the capital of drugs-related deaths in the UK.
Oh, okay. There you go.
And there are more drugs deaths up there than anywhere else in the UK at the moment. And I think they've held the record for quite some time. But I think that's illegal drugs.
I remember a quote from John Lennon. I'm a real Beatles fan. Saw them a couple of times in person, I remember a quote from him where he said, if people would get tired of television, there would be no more television. If people would get tired of war, there would be no more war. And if people would, I'm saying, if people would get tired of addiction and watching our loved ones die and suffer and struggle, we would get rid of addiction. But we're nowhere near that yet. And it's gone on for years where people have been dying from unsafe supply of drugs and fentanyl and all this stuff. But what they're really dying from is what's underneath their need to use the addiction. That's what they're really dying from. And when that can be healed, they don't need the fentanyl. They don't want that anymore. And I'm living proof of that. So,
I mean, you can't get addicted to painkillers. I mean, somebody lives in pain all the time. I mean, I'm constantly in pain, and I only take painkillers when I absolutely can't stand it, the pain, any longer.
And I really understand that. And it's the same with Crohn's. It's a chronic illness. Yeah. It's a painful, debilitating illness. I don't take anything anymore until I can't stand it anymore. And then I only take a little tiny bit, and I tell somebody I've taken it. So I'm accountable.
Yeah. But
yeah. There are other ways to deal with pain as well. I mean, I know that pain is real. Yeah. I know. And there are other ways to deal with chronic pain so that we don't have to be struggling with addiction in our lives as well as chronic pain. Yeah. Because that's a combination, which I have lived.
Chronic pain's no fun whatsoever.
No, and when you put addiction on top of chronic pain, you want to live or die anymore.
There are some days I can't even get out of bed in the mornings. I hate so much.
I know.
But I do eventually. One has to get up in the morning.
And I don't want to end the show on a downer. I want to say that there is hope with chronic pain. With anything, there is hope.
Yeah.
And we do a little better maybe than what we've been doing. And that's the goal.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think if anybody can take anything from what we've chatted about this evening or today, it's there is hope out there. There is help absolutely. Out there.
Yeah.
And you don't have help. To do it alone.
There's hope and there's help.
Yeah. And where's the best place to look for that help?
I think, you know, the internet, as problematic as it can be, you can look up on Google, you can look up your city, your town, whatever, wherever you live, and addiction counseling or family addiction, or, you know, that's how people usually find me. And by the way, we work with people all over the world. We have clients in England, we have clients in Australia, we have clients in Portugal, we have clients all over the place. If you can speak English, we can work with you, because we work exclusively over Zoom. So we can meet with you anywhere you are. And we provide, I have a number of counselors that work with me. My company is called Love with Boundaries, because we need to love and we need to do it with boundaries. So you can look up lovewithboundaries.com, and we provide a free, no obligation at all, 30-minute consultation to see what's going on with you, to see if we're a fit for you. If we're not, that's okay. If we are, we get going. And we start working with you, and we help your family, and we help your addict recover rather than stay stuck. Because this can all be healed.
Yeah.
You just need
absolutely.
To. Ways to do things. Yeah.
Terrific.
So if you're out there and you're struggling, wherever you are in the world, and you understood what I've said because you speak English, then you can get in touch with us. And what I'll do is I'll give you the link, Tim, to for people to, you know, people have to fill out a short questionnaire for us to be able to get the 30-minute consultation. So I can give you the link to that questionnaire. But if they go on to lovewithboundaries.com, they'll see it there too.
So I'll put all the links down in the description along with the links for your book. And
good.
Hopefully we'll get you some clients, but B, more importantly, get people some help that they desperately need.
Give the people the help. Yes, one family at a time we can heal this. And, you know, if your addict is still with you and hasn't died from an overdose, and hopefully that won't happen, if your addict is still with you, there is hope, definitely, for sure.
Hmm. Well, Candice, thank you so, so much for this evening.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Wow. I think that was a fantastic chat that we've had there. And if you are struggling, if you do know a family that is struggling with addiction, then reach out. All the details will be in the description. This will also be available on all the different podcast apps in the next few hours. So be sure to pass it on to anybody to know that it may help. So don't forget Tuesday, the live stream awesome quiz. And next Thursday, I'll have another fantastic guest on. And Sunday morning, there'll be a new ordinary person's extraordinary story coming out. So until next week, TTFN. Ta-ta for now. Welcome to the Tim Hill Podcast. If you have the time, you can not only listen to the episodes, but you can also watch all the shows, and you'll find the links in the description below. Thank you.